The views, information, and opinions expressed are those of the featured guests and not those of IG Wealth Management.
I'm Manjeet Minhas, one of Canada's top entrepreneurs, and so excited for you to join us today. Through a wealth of women's stories, IG is carving out a space where women's voices are heard. If you're looking for insight and inspiration through powerful storytelling that will resonate with anyone looking for the answers to the questions that we as women ask ourselves, then this series is for you. We're speaking with Taylor Lindsay Noel, an inspiring and deeply courageous 28-year-old who is the owner of Cup of Tea, a luxury loose leaf tea company that just happens to be one of Oprah's favorite things. Taylor has been on a journey fraught with the type of challenges that most of us simply can't even imagine. It started with a tragedy on July 15th, 2008. Taylor was a 14-year-old elite gymnast on track to represent Canada at the 2012 Olympic Games. Pushed by her coach to attempt a dangerous and difficult dismount from the uneven bars, she broke her neck and was instantly paralyzed from the neck down. With faith and perseverance, she paved a new path forward, metaphorically landing on her feet. Taylor went on to earn her BA in radio and television arts, and today she balances life as a business owner, motivational speaker, disability activist, and council member on the Premier's Council on Equality of Opportunity. And if that wasn't enough, she was just named the Young Entrepreneur of the Year by the Black Business and Professional Association Harry Jerome Awards, Canada's most prestigious award celebrating Black excellence. Welcome to the podcast, Taylor.
Thank you so much for having me, Wendy. Excited to speak to you.
No problem. I'm really excited to tell our audiences about your remarkable, inspiring story and talk about the past and the present and what your plans are for the future. And so it's a real pleasure to have you here today. Your story is such an inspiration, and it really is about triumph over tragedy and about resilience that has absolutely no bounds and the choice to get up every day and live fully. So let's maybe step back into time, into 2008, when you were a gymnast training for the Olympics. Can you share maybe a little bit about your life as an elite athlete and the track that you were on, and then the day everything changed?
Well, looking back now, I totally recognize I did not have a regular childhood. Just considering the fact that all of my friends were doing the same thing as me, I thought we were normal, but it definitely wasn't normal. At that time, I was training 5.5 hours a day, which was more time than I spent actually doing school. And gymnastics was my life, my job, and my passion. So that was something I really dove into headfirst, starting at 5 and up until the day of my accident when I was 14.
And so what happened on July 15th?
I went to a very regular day of summer training, went to some of our first events like trampoline and beam, and then I ended up on the bars, which just happens to be my worst event. If you were to look at any of my records from my competition to be like first, second, third on all of the other events and borderline last on bars, it's kind of a running joke in Canadian gymnastics. But I went to bars, and my coach of many years had approached me to do a skill I had never heard of, which is extremely rare because I had seen everything. I was a fan of the sport, obviously, and I kind of laughed at him because I thought it was a little ridiculous. And he kept telling me that people do it all around the world. They just haven't videotaped it yet. Back then, YouTube isn't what it is today. So I didn't really have that as an option to ask, because I get asked that a lot. Why didn't you ask to YouTube it? And he just, even though I felt something in my gut wasn't right, he kept gaslighting me, telling me I'm letting my fear cloud my judgment. I wouldn't ask you to do anything you couldn't do. And so after about an hour of crying and going back and forth, I just decided the only way to shut him up is to just do it and get over my fear. And the second time I attempted it, I landed head first, falling from the high bar, which resulted in me breaking my neck and severing my spinal cord, leaving me paralyzed from the chest down, which obviously changed my life forever.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's unbelievable and tragic. Nobody can imagine what not only was going through your mind, your coaches, all of your teammates, your colleagues, but then afterwards when you discovered you were paralyzed and that, you know, Olympic glory wasn't written in the cards then. And so what else did you, what other dreams did you have as a teenager other than the Olympics?
When I was that age, it became very clear that a lot of the girls in the sport had very wealthy families. It can be a very expensive sport to partake in. So you either come from a really wealthy family or you're working really hard to make something of yourself. And that was more so my journey. And seeing and growing up around some people who had really great generational wealth, people whose families were CEOs of Shoppers Drug Mart, I really saw a lifestyle that I wanted to be able to create for my own family. And I knew that the way to that was education. Gymnastics was going to be able to provide me the opportunity to go to higher education and have it paid for. I dreamed of going to UCLA because that's where all the top gymnasts went. And hopefully one day becoming a sports doctor, I knew that would be a quote unquote good career. Now, would I have been passionate about it? Absolutely not. But I knew that it was a good career and I knew that UCLA would give me the path to that. So that was my dream at the time. Go to the Olympics, become an Olympian. We don't have the same glory as Americans do when we go to the Olympics. So I knew I'd have to have another career, and sport, being a sports doctor made the most sense at the time.
Well, and I think that's really pragmatic of you as a teenager, because most people can't really, never mind at 14 or 13 or hell, even at, you know, when they're about to graduate at 18, really not only have that plan, but also really understand the realities of what it takes to be an adult, to be successful, but also to have multiple streams of income, multiple careers, to understand that everything has usually a finish time. And especially when you're in a athlete and so much of your life and your career up until that time is totally consumed. And no matter where you are, whether it's Canada, US, or anywhere around the world, no matter what sport it is either, and the glory after or not, it is important to understand for everybody that you did dedicate so much of your life to it, and all elite athletes do. And whether or not you know, it gets Olympic medals and or endorsements and all of the great things after that is a shot in the dark that you don't really know. But I love that you had a plan, and I hope that our audience gets that, is that you can be passionate about things, but sometimes there needs to be more of a pragmatic approach as into the what ifs, even though none of us want to think about the what ifs. And so every challenge we face in life has the power to knock the wind out of us. And so what's even more disconcerting is that the fear, we won't be able to withstand a lot of that. And so when a lot of us panic and we forget and we allow fear to really freeze us, most of us don't necessarily have the courage to fight through that. And so you spent, after the accident, a year and a half at Bloor View Rehab Center. Can you share some of the fears that you had and what you faced as you navigated your way through rehab?
There were a lot of fears going into rehab. I think my biggest fears actually, though, came right after the accident. I spent three weeks in sick kids. I had emergency surgery. And I remember waking up and the doctor didn't know I was awake, and he was talking to my mom. And it was the first time I was kind of hearing about what really happened. And he was telling my mom, you know, we don't know if she's going to be able to speak. They had to put this thing down my throat because I wasn't breathing properly during surgery. And he's like, when we take it out, it might wreck her vocal cords. We're not quite sure if she's going to be her full self because we don't know if she's had a concussion. And they're like, and she will never walk again. And so hearing all of that, almost overhearing something, terrified me, because I went from being the polar opposite. I was not just walking and able-bodied. My body felt superhuman almost at the time. And so for someone to tell me that I'm going from being a superhuman to not even be able to lift my hand by myself was just so jarring. But in the back of my head, and maybe luckily my childhood innocence of ignorance, I always said, you know, my body's just a little bit stunned at the moment and it'll thaw out and it'll be okay. So when I went to rehab, I just took all of my practice of going to gym every day and saw that as my rehab. I was going to work as hard as I could to get as much back as I can. But after about 6 months, I think the reality really sunk in that my life was going to be different. And I had the most incredible support around me, but I don't think even my best friends at the time knew how difficult it was for them when they came to see me. I'd be so happy to see them, but they'd tell me about their day and what they were going through. And we're all teenagers, and it was starting to really kick in. My life will never be like theirs. And that at 14, turning 15, was terrifying because I hadn't even had a regular childhood experience already. And I had so looked forward to that end goal of finishing gym and getting a quote unquote normal life. And so knowing I would never have it was, it was a lot. It was a lot to take in for sure.
And so who did you have around you supporting you, maybe talking to you, walking through that, bouncing the ideas off of every day? Or what were you doing to support, you know, the idea of what was going to be next? Were there counselors, mentors? Were you reading books? Like, how were you finding that courage to push through and do that rehab? Because from what I understand, it's really hard work.
It's a lot of hard work. And I think I would have been worse off if I hadn't been an athlete before. I saw kids who had never worked out a day in their life get into a car accident, be sent to rehab. And those were the kids who really struggled. Because to ask someone to move their body when they've never really done it before outside of it, now inside of a foreign body, is one of the hardest things you can ever do. So I definitely think I had a way different mindset than most people who I was around. But in terms of practical things I did, I think, again, just playing into my innocence at that age really did help me. Because I think if I had my injury at 28, which how old I am now, I think I would have spiraled a lot quicker than I did. I definitely hit depression around 16 or 17. But it was definitely a delayed response because I just was dealing with so many other things while also pretending to be positive and happy for everyone else because I was so scared that not only am I a physical burden, I didn't want to be an emotional burden as well. So I was a person to always try to make people laugh, even though I was the one who had experienced this accident. It was a very weird psychological trip that I was going on for multiple years.
Yeah, being young, I think you had that work ethic and determination that you've had, you know, since you were 5 years old in being an elite athlete. So that helped you, which is fantastic. But also you, what maybe got you in trouble or, you know, had the accident was that people-pleasing part that we all have, right? And how you take it onto yourself. You can be the most optimistic person, but we can all struggle at different times. And so you decided to go back to high school. And that high school can be a mean place in regular times, but now you went from being this elite champion athlete and now you were in a wheelchair. And so how hard was not only that choice, but that transition? You talk about it hitting you late and depression and other things mentally, but how was it not only physically for those around you? Did you make new friends? How did you decide you were going to focus on your education and you now and what you needed?
Well, at first when you're in Bloorview, they do have a school there inside of it. And I only took about 2 courses a semester instead of having a full load. So when I was going and talking about transitioning back to high school, they wanted to send me to a school that was for kids with disabilities. And I already knew right away that that was not what I wanted. I knew that for me, mentally, I was still the same person and was capable of keeping up with schoolwork and that the real world wouldn't have me sheltered. So why am I going to go to a school that would shelter me when I go to university? That's not going to be my path. So that was an argument with some of my counselors at the time, but I was very adamant I wanted to go back. It wasn't as easy as I thought because I also was transitioning out of rehab where I become very, very comfortable. I almost I almost enjoyed my time probably too much because I had full-time care. The nurses and I got along super well. My room was a party room. They would take their breaks in there. So to go from 24-hour care to being reliant on my mom, moving into a home I had never been in, and transitioning back to high school all at once, it was so much. But my high school really did, you know, welcome me back with open arms. And a lot of people had questions because they went from being the jock or the athlete to what happened to Taylor. But throughout my high school experience, it was almost rediscovering myself because it was my first time in my entire life to approach people as just Taylor and not Taylor the gymnast, Taylor the future Olympian, or have some kind of title with me. I had to figure out who I was separate from an identity that was crafted for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that is really an important point, because I think so many of us, when we see failure, mistakes, or even successes, especially as women, we start to identify that way and think that that is who we are. And when that changes, as it inevitably does, and it does a 180 sometimes, you go from success to failure or vice versa, because nothing is static, even in the business world, you do have to grapple with the fact that you are not your successes, your mistakes, your failures, that you are a different individual from that. And that is usually something that many of us have to grapple with as adults and sometimes have those tools, but as a young person, it's even more. And so what would you say to other women who are facing extreme challenges and really trying to find their footing as life is happening to them?
I would tell them to allow themselves to feel and not feel guilty for not always having it together. I was so terrified of feeling emotions deeply, because you are kind of taught as an athlete to become almost like a robot. Like, you do this, you do X, you do Y, you do Z, and it has this result. And there wasn't really a lot of room for emotion in that. And so when I had my accident, I treated it like such. Okay, I broke my neck, severed my spinal cord, I go to rehab, I go back to life, and things move on. And there was no room or grace in that for allowing myself to be like, this sucks. I am scared. I am hurting. My coach was like a father figure to me. And so there was just a lot of emotional things that I just completely casted aside, because as women, we're taught to be strong and we have to keep. I know it's so funny to me when people talk about men are taught to be strong and that they can't have emotions. But I feel like more so now, women are taught to do that. And right. So if we act with emotion, then we're seen as weak. And so we don't do it anymore. And I definitely played into that. And it was a very toxic relationship I had with my mental health, because I just did not acknowledge my feelings. So, yeah.
I really admire that you're speaking about it, but recognize that it is important. And I like that you're saying, it's okay for us to say, this sucks. Yeah. Like, that I don't enjoy this. This isn't my plan. Like that in those two simple words, I love it because it says a lot. You know, when I was growing up, my dad used to always say to me, life isn't fair. And as a brown woman, I didn't understand that, but I definitely very quickly did in all the negative ways. But then I started to turn that narrative around and when I could, to make it as part of my Teflon that life isn't fair for me in good ways and positive ways. But of course, that's not the way that it was meant for me. to be said. And my grandmother used to always say, it's a really loosely translated Punjabi verb, is that be like a flower, survive the rain, but use it to grow. And I think that so many of us at different parts of our life see it as this sucks, but we look back at it and see, well, what did we get out of it? It might still suck and that's okay. But there are some things that we do grow from it. It sometimes takes time to see that. But it is important to be able to feel and share those feelings. And as I tell my husband, when I do feel, I'm not looking for a response back. I'm not looking for you to fix the problem. I'm just looking for you to listen to me and let me feel and have those emotions and get angry or sad and then hopefully, you know, move on from it. So you've talked talked a lot about how you've had to pivot in your life. And you've pivoted from gymnastics to rehab, from high school to internships, from your podcast to your luxury tea business. Definitely a lot of pivots. And so I really do believe, and I know you do too, that pivots are an opportunity for a new beginning. And so your luxury tea business was a new beginning. What inspired you to not only start the business, but what about tea really was your passion and fascinated you?
There's so much that went into putting me in the position to start my business, but the core of it was when I was in university, I went for radio and television arts, and I started a podcast because although I had great internships with ET Canada and Global News and actually the Canadian Olympic Committee, I realized that a 9-to-5 schedule with my nursing, with my physical rehab, and just not being able to tell the stories I wanted to tell was going to be very difficult. And I, having an immigrant mom, you know, complaining is not an option. So if I have a problem with it, I got to fix it. And that looked like using my own platform. And starting Tea Time with Tay, I knew that in order to make money with the podcast, I had to have a sponsor. So from the very inception of the podcast, I knew if I talked about a product consistently, I can probably get them to sponsor me and go from there. Tea had always been a vessel for great conversations in my household. My house, we call it the, you know, the vortex where people come in. You want to stay for an hour, but you're leaving at 3 a.m. And always over a cup of tea at the table. And it was very natural. And I would talk about David's tea in every single episode because I, at the time, was obsessed and thought that it was, they had so many flavors and it was great and it was fun. And eventually, as my audience grew, I reached out to them, hoping they would sponsor me. And I never heard back. And once again, it was one of those moments where, like, I had a problem that was presenting itself because I had really dug myself into the David's tea hole. I wasn't branching out. And I knew that if I had to solve a problem, I need to figure out something to do. And that looked like, okay, if they don't want to sponsor me, I'll make my own tea. And in that process, being like, I can make a whole company. And if I made a company, how would I want it to look? How would I want it to feel? And how can I be different in a very old,
right,
kind of boring market? And that was where a cup of tea was birthed out of.
And so how did you learn about tea? Or did you know a lot about the making of it?
I didn't know anything.
Okay.
I was a consumer, but I had no idea about the business side or how it was done. And I didn't go to business school, never took a business course. So I was really a child of Google University, as I like to call it. And the first thing I ever Googled was how to legally start a tea business in Canada. Every step of the way was Googling and YouTubing. And I think it just goes to show that now if I were to do it again, I think a business degree would have been great. But I think it goes to show that if you're really, really, really dedicated to something, you can figure it out. And I will be the first one to admit I've been in meetings with manufacturers and the first time I heard of an MOQ, I was Googling what that meant while on the phone with them because I had no idea. And sometimes you have to fake it a little bit until you make it.
Right.
But step by step, over a year and a half, I put the puzzle pieces together and launched Cup of Tea in November 26, 2018, and have been really proud of the journey that has been the last almost 4 years. It's been absolutely insane in the best way.
So for those listening, MOQ means minimum order quantity. You don't have to Google it. We will help you out there. And that's really fantastic. I love that it was a part of your life and you really saw something that existed that you wanted to make better and unique and something that was high end. So what hurdles have you faced in the high end tea market? Because, you know, obviously in Canada, we drink a lot more coffee thanks to a couple big chains than we drink tea. But across the pond, of course, tea is extremely big in Asia, in Europe. And so what are the hurdles that you have faced in a very competitive market, but also a niche market?
Absolutely. And that was a really big decision going into it, right? You have to decide, where do you want to fall? Do you want to fall mid-range? Do you want to fall, you know, accessible to everyone? Or do you want to have a little bit more of an upscale feel? And I had a conversation with myself and I talked about the things that I've really enjoyed as a consumer from any business. And one of those things were the opportunity to gift it, the unboxing experience, and high quality products. And all three of those things that make me happy tend to lend to more of a luxury feel. My favorite colors are black, gold, silver, chromes, those colors. And cup of tea just feels a little fancy to me. The name just feels a little bit more upscale. And so that when I made that decision to focus on that, I knew that I would be alienating some people. But I also strongly believed that if we were able to really hit all of the different goals I had in terms of packaging, branding, quality, that the right people would find it. And even if they ended up getting it as a gift one day, that they would recognize the value. And I don't believe that we are ripping anybody off by any means. We aren't that far of a price difference from our competitors who are in the mid-range. And I think the proof is in the pudding that consumers really are drawn to what we do and what we're able to present in the market.
Got it. Great. So I have to ask the Oprah question. How did you manage to get on the list of Oprah's favorite things, and how did you get the news?
I think the first answer to that is manifestation, even though I didn't realize it. And I say that because Oprah was one of the only shows my mom and I really, Oprah and Survivor, funny enough, were like the two shows.
Me too, me and my mom too.
And I just remember, those were the two shows that we bonded over, and I would rush home after gym to watch with her. When I wrote my entrance letter into university, I said I wanted to be a hybrid of myself, Maya Angelou, and Oprah. And on my dream board, I had always O Magazine because I wanted to get our products in there eventually. But I didn't think it would happen that quickly. And it happened on July 5th. So my accident was July 15, 2008. July 15, 2020, I woke up. It's July 15th is the hardest day of the year for me every single year. And I went for breakfast. I saw this email that said, "Hi, my name is Blink from O Magazine. We found you on Instagram. We think that your products look great. We would love if you can send one of everything for consideration of the December issue." And instantly it felt fake because I had only subscribed to Oprah Magazine. And as a millennial, we don't subscribe. It just didn't seem, and the day that it fell on, it seemed impossible. But, and so I deleted it, went about my day.
Oh no.
Oh yeah, I deleted it. And then it couldn't shake it. And so I took it out of the trash, called the number, and it ended up being real. That turned into weeks of sending product, curating a custom set, and then eventually sending that to Gail King and Oprah for consideration. And they came back and they loved it. And that started and changed my entire life and career for sure. She has the Oprah effect. It's very real and still very true to this day.
Well, that's a fantastic story. And I truly believe in karma. And I do think that manifestation in a variety of different ways happens. So that is such a beautiful story. And you do have a fantastic product. The packaging is beautiful. The story of you and the product and how it came to life is really fantastic. And I do love that sometimes some things are serendipitous, how individuals and the world defines you. So what a great story. And congratulations on definitely all your success. So next, I'd like to talk about surrounding yourself with strengths. And your story demonstrates the power of community and what can happen when people are surrounded by supportive groups of friends, family, and even strangers, to be quite honest. And so you often speak about your mom who is by your side through it all. Can you tell us a little bit about the strength and support you received from her in particular?
If anyone who knows my mom, Miss Rowena Lindsay is a firecracker. We call her Hurricane Rowena because sometimes she'll come into a room and just shake things up. But at the core of it, her nickname amongst all of my friends and myself, more than I call her mom, I call her MB, which stands for Mama Bear. She is the truest mama bear you will ever find. She's protective. She is a force. And she will enter a room and her presence is known. And I think growing up and seeing that as someone who has an immigrant mother, she came from Jamaica and built a really great life for us here. seeing her strength and being a single mom made me realize that really nothing that happens to me is impossible to work through. And even after my accident, I remember even a couple days after, she goes, you know, Taylor, your brain is still functioning. You're gonna get through this. And I still, none of my expectations for you have changed. And a lot of people would think, oh, that's like a lot to take in when you're just going through a lot. But for me, it was exactly what I needed because I wasn't gonna give up. I very easily, people would have understood if I didn't go to university or start a business and just kind of lived. And my mom was like, no, that's not what we do. And I'm very grateful for that kind of energy and support around me because it continued to make me strive for as much as I can achieve in this lifetime. And I think I'm making the most out of my life considering all of the barriers and challenges that are in my everyday life.
Right. Yeah, agreed. Were there any unexpected people who simply showed up offering support when you were going through the challenges that you were in the beginning?
A lot. I had so much support from strangers. It was insane. My story was the front page of the Toronto Star. And that obviously brings a lot. I didn't really at the time realize, I was 14. I didn't really realize the power of the newspaper at the time. And people still read the newspaper. And that had strangers donating money and we had so many people show up at my hospital or my rehab that they had to give my mom a beeper to, you know, ask her because people were trying to sneak up and just see me and they actually shut down part of a wing at SickKids because it was becoming so crowded. And so I was from day one filled with a lot of support, not from the people I would expect. Gymnastics Canada, Gymnastics Ontario did not show up in the way that they should. It was right before the Olympics that year, and they didn't want that to cloud Olympic glory. Even though I had dedicated myself to Canada and bringing awareness to our sport, they were not supportive until we talked publicly about it, and then they sent flowers after that. But it was surprising and really hurtful, but I was surrounded by so much love that it didn't really matter that they weren't there because I knew that even post-sport, I would still have support around me. And that was really, really imperative to helping me get through the hardest time of my life.
Yeah, well, I do have to say that that's very unfortunate, very disappointing that they did not. Like you say, after dedicating your life and being such an advocate for gymnastics and sport. So I would definitely say that they need to do better. And it's unfortunate that sometimes organizations like that only step up somewhat only when they're called out. And it is hopefully that they've been able to reflect and change the way that they operate, because you're an amazing human and you should, and everybody else who's ever affected by tragedy should be still supported and have love and support around them, because and nobody knows what is going to happen to them the next hour, the next day. And so that is definitely very disappointing. So how do you think that it is for women, how important do you think it is for women to surround themselves with a supportive network, whether it be other women, whether it be friends, family, you know, even an online network, like people that you don't know? How has it affected you and how would you suggest to others in order to find that?
I am an only child, so my friend group is my sisterhood, and I don't know what or who I would be without my friends. We are so incredibly close. And, you know, that saying, if you look at the closest people around you, show me your friends and I'll show you my future, your future. And I have the most incredible, passionate, successful group of passionate women around me. I have friends who are teachers, friends who work for government, actresses, and people who are just so passionate about whatever they're doing. And I think having that support around me makes me want to be a better person, makes me feel so great to see them do well. And we just genuinely love each other. And having that sisterhood has been so important to me. I wish that I could be a person to say that I had really great male role models in my life. But unfortunately, that's not so much the case. You know, my father was never really in my life after age 4. And even though we live in the same city, and he very much could have been, which is, you know, disappointing. My coach let me down. There's so many men along my life journey who have let me down, but I do hope that I could say that in the future. You know, I see him as my mentor a little bit, but Matt Higgins is someone who kind of recently stepped into my life out of meeting him in a clubhouse room. And for those who might not know him, he's was a guest shark on Shark Tank, and he's just an incredible human overall. And so now in my adulthood, I'm looking for those male mentors. So I think having a balance of both is important. I know that you, Manjeet, grew up, you know, having your family and you work with your brother and all of these incredible things. And I think the balance of male and female energy is really imperative and important to a person in general. So that's something I'm hoping to have more of in the future.
Right. Yeah. I love that you're aware of it, but also understand where you are today, that it has helped you. And I think that it's important to be open to a variety of people in and out of our lives and to cherry pick what they bring that you need at a certain point in time. And they can push you in the right ways, or they can just be there as support. And I think that we all need those people at different times. We need a different supportive network, but we all need them. Nobody does anything alone. And no matter what we're doing, it is definitely, you know, it takes a network and it takes a village and a variety of people, like you say. So let's talk a little bit about disability and inclusion. So 15% of the world's population discloses some type of disability. That's over 1 billion people. 1 billion people. On a daily basis, people encounter the type of biases and barriers that you are definitely all too familiar with. So you describe yourself as a female, Black, disabled small business owner. What has your experience been as a Black, disabled woman?
Difficult. difficult in the sense that, not that I need anyone to believe in me because I believe in me, but it is so incredibly frustrating when you can just tell someone doesn't take you seriously off of first glance. And that's anywhere I am, really. If I'm just navigating the public, people talk to me like I'm a child, talk to me slowly. When I'm in initial meetings with people, specifically before Oprah threw things list, they'd be like, okay, can I talk to your boss? Or do you need to run this by someone? And I'm like, I'm the boss. I created this business. I'm like, oh, okay. So your family business. I'm like, no, me, just me. It used to frustrate me a lot, but now I see it as an opportunity for education. And I can't expect someone to understand my life and the things and barriers I have. And so instead of leading with anger, I tried to lead with an educational lens. And that's because if I were to look back at myself at 14, I knew nothing about disability, really anyone with a disability. And so if you haven't experienced it or been around it, it's hard to know what you don't see. And we aren't seen. And that's why I need to continue to be seen in as many ways as I can, so people can start to change their perception. And one of those ways is through my business. And the other ways is through being a motivational speaker and hopefully doing more media work, because, you know, representation, as we know, is so important. And we have it, and we've had it changing in the BIPOC community in terms of recognition, but the disability community is within that is completely still a mess.
Right. And I agree with you. Representation matters on all different fronts for us to understand what makes us unique, what makes us similar, what gives us advantages and disadvantages in our own mind or in others. But if we don't talk about it, how can we expect others to know about it, how to react, how to feel, but really just understand it? But that doesn't mean, like you say, that we can't get frustrated, that we can't have anger sometimes towards it, because I definitely still do have have a lot of, do you need to pass that by your brother? Are you sure you're old enough to sign? Yeah, I get that. And unfortunately, it doesn't go away. And I think that it then shifts. And I know that you've had that shift where you had to advocate for yourself in the beginning, but now that shift into the desire to advocate for others, which is unbelievably not only sometimes hard, but also extremely commendable. And so when and how did that happen?
I knew that there had to be, I recognize that, you know, through I think my faith a little bit too, that my purpose in life is more than just myself. And, you know, if I had the opportunity to serve as an inspiration or a voice for others, it's something I'm going to take advantage of because I had so much support around me. And in my daily life, that looks like being a disability advocate in as many ways as I can, being on different councils within my province, also being on the board, a board member of Spinal Cord Injury Ontario, and just trying to make daily life changes that could make somebody living with a disability navigate through this world with ease. And it's not an easy process. I'm sitting, currently I'm on a board with people who are at minute, I think the closest person to me in age is about 40 years age difference. And I know that I was brought on for a specific reason. And sometimes it's a little frustrating in itself, but I'm here and I'm going to make the change that I feel like needs to be made and really scream from the rooftops because people with disabilities are just not one thing. We are so multifaceted. We have different needs and we deserve to have as much of a life in a healthy and happy life as anybody else. And I will do everything in my power to make sure that happens.
Yeah, agreed. And I love how you talk about, and the feeling I always get is that, you know, you want to talk about all that you are and instead of all that you are not. It's not about what you can't do or what people with disabilities can't do. It's what they can. And like your mom told you, is that you got everything up here still, which is so important, right? And to shift the focus. So I would like to touch a little bit on the social media part of it, because I know you've encountered some situations online where people treat you one way, and then when they see you and meet you in person and become aware of your disability, they treat you differently. So how do you deal with that?
It's a little funny actually now, because you can always see it in someone's face. They're just taken aback. And I'm like, what were you expecting? Oh, like a white male, a white male in business, or what, like a white female? And I think the being a person of color and being a Black woman in business is, oh wow. And then you add the disability layer, like, oh my gosh, as if I'm like a unicorn or something out here. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just one of those opportunities to make sure that I'm sure you've had this, people in your family have said this to you, but sometimes in order to be in the same spaces, you have to work harder. You have to put and make sure that you don't make as many mistakes. And I think I had a lot of pressure to make sure that when I talked about business, that I knew everything because they already have low expectations and I don't want to meet them. But now I just am being more comfortable as a business owner. I feel more comfortable just being myself and saying, I know that you wouldn't expect this of me, but my expectations of myself are actually far greater than what I'm doing now. So you can see me here today, but in 5 years, you won't even recognize me. And being confident in saying that, because I know that one, I will live up to that. And two, it'll shake up the perception of what quote unquote perceived limitations could be.
Yeah, you're still right. The first 10 years of my entrepreneurial career, I made it a very big point to know absolutely everything, not only about my business, but everybody else's businesses in the alcohol business and every, you know, thing I could just eat it all up. And it definitely gave me an amazing base, but it was very time consuming. But also I felt like I was often trying to be maybe something and somebody that I wasn't. And so now I sometimes embrace when I'm asked something and I can say, I don't know. And I think that, there's a lot of power in that too. I'm still, no doubt about it, very well researched and love to have all my I's dotted and T's crossed because that gives me comfort. But it kind of calms my nerves down. But I would say that it is important to understand as you grow, especially as an entrepreneur, to be able to say, I don't know, or I'll get back to you, or figure that out, or know who to go to in order to get some answers and figure it out together. And I think that through the pandemic, many of us have also discovered that we can collaborate. We can, you know, help each other out, even if we're in the same industry, just as business owners, but as women, as people who are struggling and finding challenges, because being an entrepreneur is full of challenges and things we never learn. There's no rule book here.
I think that's really, you know, you hit it on the nail when you said through the pandemic, because previous to the pandemic, I didn't really talk to anybody, any other business owners, because I just, again, felt like I didn't really know a lot, didn't have business school background, and was almost intimidated to have a conversation. But one of my really close friends now, Layla, I'm sure you remember her from Happy Pops. She was on Dragon's Den, and she and I have been friends for a little while now, and I had an open conversation with her when I thought I was going to shut my business down. And she told me, hey, this is what's happening on my business. I know you see this online, but this is what's really happening. And it was one of those moments where I'm like, not everyone who I thought had it together has every single facet together. And those conversations and collaborations and being open to talking. And I'm the first one to say, I know what I know and I know what I don't know, but I'm always open to learning. And I think having that mindset as an entrepreneur and knowing that not everything that glitters is gold is so important, because otherwise you'll drive yourself crazy.
Very, very true. And I'm going to quote Maya Angelou, because I have this up in my office, because I know you're a big fan. You just told me that you do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better.
I love that one.
And it's very, very true, because we can't all be expected to know everything at any point in time. In my life, Manu has always been be 1% better every day before you go to bed. And I schedule that into my life in a variety of different ways. And I think that it is really important. We can't be expected to know everything, but we can have an open mind to learning. And I think that that is a mindset that the more that we have it and the more that we can teach those around us, we'll all be better for it.
Could not agree more.
So let's talk about wellness and mental health. When we're mentally healthy, we enjoy our life and the people in it. We can be creative, learn new things, take risks. And so how do you manage to stay mentally positive and balanced? I don't always love that word balance, but I think you kind of know where I'm going with that.
Yeah, of course. Mental health is, oh gosh, it is such a journey. Again, coming from a Caribbean background, mental health wasn't necessarily a focus that we had in the household. And it wasn't because you weren't able to talk about what you're going through, but it just is a little bit stigmatized, I guess. And so I battled the first couple years and what I call was a functioning depressed person, where I could show up, I could go to school, I could get good grades, I could be social, but at the end of the day, I was hurting badly and dark, in a very dark place. And it was only when I almost really hit rock bottom that I decided that, one, I probably should talk to someone about it, and two, it's okay not to always be okay. And that shift in mindset and dragging myself off out of a very dark place gave me, one, a lot more empathy for others, and two, the ability to recognize when I need to take a step back. Now, when I was going through the best thing that ever happened in my entrepreneurial life, when we got announced to be on a prescription things list, the day after I knew that we were going to be on the list was the day I signed up for online therapy again, because I knew that I was going to go through a very high. And then when those glitz and glamours and interviews and all that fun stuff goes away, life gets back to normal. And so I know now the tools and to recognize when I might need to tap into therapy and when I don't. And I think that really has changed my life.
And I like that as a continuous tool in your toolkit. It's not something that you went to once and kind of said, I'm done with. It's something that you're continuously working on and are self-aware enough to know that when you need it or when you think you are going to need it. And so what would your advice to others be who are going through traumatic changes and struggling with mental wellness right now?
Talk about it and talk about it even to just one person that you trust. And, you know, it's often a lot of people say they don't have anyone to talk to about it. And so if you don't feel like you do, which I'm sure you do, but if you don't feel like you do, write it out and then burn it. There's something so cathartic. I don't know if I'm a pyromaniac, but there's something so cathartic about burning something and just letting it just be released from yourself. We contain and we hold on to so much. And when you hold on to emotions, it actually starts to take a physical form within your body. So releasing it in some way, shape, or form is imperative. And don't be afraid to ask for help. You don't want to wait till the last minute to ask for help when you can really get ahead of it if you feel like you're not yourself.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I feel that many people feel that they might be judged if they talk about it with those around them for their feelings or what's going on, or that the fact that they don't even understand what's going on. And so I truly believe also in releasing it. I'm a big fan of journaling. I have been since I was young, definitely. Even when my mom read my journal and I was very upset as a teenager, I maybe took a little pause and then I definitely got back into it. But I do feel like everybody has to have a release in some way, because it can take a very physical toll, which not many of us are told, not only when we're young, but even as women, to understand that how that stress can manifest in a lot of different ways, through physical pain, through, like you say, a lot of different things that can be really tragic and have long-lasting effects that we don't expect it to.
So true.
So Taylor, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. Throughout your journey, you've persevered, you've thrived and grew into the remarkable young woman that you are. And you're such an inspiration, and you've shown us that there is life after tragedy. And so we're all shaped by our experiences. And so what have you learned about yourself going through this journey?
I am tough. And I am very comfortable saying that. I have been through a lot in my life. I'm 28 years old and I have experienced a lot. Right. But I think through it all, I think like you said, the biggest thing is that I've learned that there's so much life after tragedy. And so whenever that next thing, because there's always that thing that happens in life, hits me, I know that I'm gonna be able to get through it. And I may not recognize it tomorrow or the day after, but when you had that moment of realization that you had to go through it to be the person that you are, to end up in the place that you are. And I had that realization when I started my business. Everything I had been through was to get me here. And I'm so proud of the person I am today. And I think we need to be more comfortable saying that. We should be our own biggest cheerleaders. And I think so often, especially when we're told, no, don't do that. But I try to give myself a pat on the back as much as possible, because if there's one person in this life you need to be proud of, it's yourself, because it's so hard. It's so hard, but it's so worth it. And I think and hope my example shows that it's worth it to work through tragedy.
Right. And that staying down is a choice.
It is,
you know, you choose every single day when you wake up that you are going to be proud of yourself, that you are going to give your all in whatever you are doing that day and make a difference and choose happiness. So I really do admire that. And I think your story really does talk about something that a lot of entrepreneurs don't discover, is that results happen over time, that it's not overnight. That a lot of hard work, consistency, and patience in a variety of ways definitely are what make the difference. And because a lot of people do expect when they read or thanks to the media sometimes, life-changing things to happen overnight in the positive ways, but they don't. Nobody's story finds success very quickly or overnight.
Yeah, it's that is the big, I mean, if you're ever wanting to be an entrepreneur, let me tell you, It does not happen overnight. And even the things that when people, you know, when getting on Oprah's room, things like, oh, it all happened overnight. It's like, no, that was,
like you said, July to December. And then
so many, like a year and a half of preparation just for the business. But I think it's like a lifetime of, like I said, manifestation, really just working at every different aspect of my life to be prepared for the opportunity. Opportunities come every single day, but if you're not prepared for them, you won't be able to optimize them. And I was able to optimize an opportunity because I was prepared. And that is years worth of life experience and time and sacrifice for one, what people think is overnight success.
Agreed. I actually say this to my 12-year-old daughter a lot, which is preparation meets opportunity. And it is so, so true. I think, I don't know if she gets it yet because she's still young.
Keep telling her.
It is something that I truly believe in also, because I feel like I was ready for so many opportunities that have come my way that have been maybe part of the plan or not, because I was prepared in a variety of different ways for that. And I think that is something that we can all get from your story too, which is quite fantastic. So one last question. You are such an inspiration to so, so many people. And so who is your inspiration? Who is your hero?
My hero... it's so hard to pick just one. I know the cliche thing to say is your parent, but my mom really is a hero in my life. She is just the most resilient firecracker I've ever been able to have in my life. Oprah obviously is a huge inspiration to me. She had a lot of no's before some big yeses in her life, and she was prepared for those opportunities. And I'm going to say one of my biggest heroes is also myself. And I want to really just reiterate the fact that you need to be able to look to yourself for inspiration and really be able to look back at your journey in life and be so proud that you worked through heartbreak, you worked through getting fired, you worked through health issues and made it to the person that you are today. You can't expect others to one day be inspired by you if you don't believe in your journey as well. So I think those are the three heroes in my life.
I couldn't have said it better. That is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. You know, I have a saying at the front of one of my most favorite notebooks saying, choose yourself, choose your happiness, choose your well-being, choose your passion every time. And I think that it is important that we do have to understand what we do has to be for ourselves, and that we do have to choose ourselves. Sometimes our own sanity, sometimes our own mental health, our own well-being, our own physical self and happiness. So that was really beautifully said. Thank you so much, Taylor. Thank you so much for joining us today, Taylor. It was a really inspiring conversation, and I really enjoyed getting to know more about your journey. And also looking forward to, I know there will be some great things that we see coming from you and your story ahead. So definitely I'm going to be watching closely. And thanks for everyone listening for tuning in today. I encourage you to find the wealth in your own stories. And always remember, there's so much life after a tragedy. We look forward to having you back for our next episode presented by IG Wealth Management. You can learn more by visiting ig.ca/women. And you can also find that link in the description of this episode. Cheers, and see you next time.
This has been A Wealth of Women Stories, hosted by Manjeet Minhas and presented by IG Wealth Management. The views, information, and opinions expressed are those of the featured guests and not those of IG Wealth Management.